the world that had always been a scar on the face of the galaxy, a planet of metal and stone, where the skies were forever draped in smog, and the Earth concealed ancient mechanisms and forgotten cities within its depths. There was no space for the weak here. Everything was built upon calculation, durability, and the flawlessness of design. From childhood, he perceived the world as a puzzle to be solved. Every tower, every wall, every fortress in his imagination became a schematic with perfect proportions, supply lines, and internal galleries. Where other children played, he disassembled and reassembled mechanisms, creating from stone and steel something that could withstand the test of centuries. His mind was cold and precise, like a measuring instrument. Yet within this precision lay an innate bitterness. He perceived the world's imperfections, its relentless tendency towards decay and chaos. He despised weakness, and even more so, incompetence and disorder. When the father came, adorned in gold and surrounded by resplendent warriors, he did not see a deity. He saw a master wielding the grandest project in history, the unification of humanity. And he agreed to become part of this design, not for love, but for perfection, to build something that would not crumble under the weight of time. His legion became the hammer and the anvil of the great crusade. They advanced to where it was necessary not merely to fight, but to erect fortresses, to rebuild shattered worlds from scratch. They were masters of siege and assault, capable of turning any enemy citadel into ruins and any barren field into an impregnable fortress. Yet a harsh price was always paid for their successes. He tolerated no mistakes. In his army, discipline was not simply a rule. It was law, the violation of which could cost one's life. Any deviation from his orders was deemed a crime against the very essence of war. He did not know forgiveness. He recalled every injustice, every shadow of doubt, every word cast at the integrity of his methods. Over time, this bitterness grew. He saw other brothers receive glory and honors for victories that, in his view, were merely superficial gleam. He witnessed intricately planned and perfectly executed campaigns attributed to others, while his work remained in the shadows. He watched worlds he fought for repeatedly fall back into barbarism, obliterating all he had constructed. And at some point, he ceased to believe in the grand plan. If humanity itself rejects order, why save it? This question took root in his mind. If his brothers in arms scorn him, why consider them his brothers at all? In a heart once ablaze with the pursuit of perfection, there lingered only a cold conviction. Everything must be rebuilt from scratch, but first, everything must be destroyed. When the time for choice arrived, he chose the side of those who promised him the freedom to create without limits. Those who did not demand his worship but offered him power. He brought his knowledge, his machines, and his legions to new masters, and under his leadership, fortresses began to rise, no longer serving for defense. They became symbols of an eternal siege. He believed he could build a perfect world, but instead, he created perfect tools of destruction. And it is said, if in silence you listen to the rumble of siege cannons, somewhere within it you can catch the rhythm of his heart, cold, precise, endlessly weary of imperfection. The hero of today's story is Perturabo, the most talented son of the Emperor, capable of building everything except friendly relationships, fallen from his own shame. Unlike most of his brothers, the Primarch of the Fourth Legion, abducted from his father's laboratory, was not found by the local inhabitants of the planet on which his incubation pod landed. On the contrary, he himself emerged to the people. But only after the glory of his astonishing deeds spread throughout the world. It was told that the strange boy was a phenomenal fighter, despite his age and childlike appearance, and moreover, incredibly intelligent and talented. Perturabo's adoptive home planet, Olympia, at that time was a civilized world, presumably settled in the last years of the Dark Age of technology. Despite its self-sufficiency in most resources, Olympia experienced a shortage of minerals necessary for the production of high-tech equipment and weapons. Once upon a time, the world had abundant reserves of such substances, but greedy ancestors lost almost everything except for tiny remnants the quantity of which was only enough for Perturabo to later draw conclusions about the civilization's origin on Olympia. Culture and progress on the planet stagnated, remaining at the level of a slave-owning society, and numerous states endlessly warred with each other over the meager fertile territories. Therefore, when rumors about an extraordinary child traveling between settlements began to spread, the ruler of one of the city-states, the tyrant Damekos, wisely decided to take the boy in before he became a powerful adversary. The warriors the tyrant sent to find him returned much earlier than expected. Perturabo was discovered almost at the edge of a cliff with a city nearby. For reasons known only to him, the boy was heading towards Lochos. For the first time among majestic buildings which far surpassed anything he had seen before, the young Primarch felt amazement and resentment. At first glance at any grand structure, he admired the architect's talent, but his admiration faded in an instant. The knowledge residing in his mind reminded him of the formulas and materials necessary for constructing such edifices. A mind too perceptive robbed the child of the joy of discoveries. And yet, upon seeing the palace of Damekos towering over the entire city-state, Perturabo was struck with awe. Naturally, he quickly unraveled all the architectural tricks employed by the building's creators. Later, when choosing his quarters in the castle, the remarkable child would prefer to live in the most remote tower. Meeting the tyrant, Perturabo showed not the slightest reverence or respect towards Damekos. He was unreserved in expressing his thoughts directly and almost crudely, to the utter shock of the guards surrounding the ruler. However, the wise Damekos forgave the boy everything. The ruler rightly presumed that the best course was to keep the extraordinary child in Lochos, lest someone else utilize his genius to their advantage. Wanting to witness the boy's remarkable skill with his own eyes, the tyrant asked him to demonstrate his blacksmithing mastery. Astonishing the onlookers with his speed and dexterity, Perturabo crafted a magnificent sword. Impressed, Damekos offered the boy resources, mentors, and patronage in exchange for his presence in the castle. The ruler saw what a powerful living instrument was now within his grasp, and was already calculating in his mind the military value of the grown alien, blatantly ignoring other merits. Perturabo read all this on Damekos's face and asked for what purposes he might be needed, peaceful or military. The young Primarch wished to gift humanity creations that would ease people's lives, not weapons. The ruler lied, claiming that Lochos waged no wars, but he did not exclude the possibility of Perturabo's genius contributing to weapon creation. He then added that, contrary to his own words about striving for peaceful creation, the boy nonetheless forged a sword, not a plough. At the time of this meeting, the young Perturabo appeared to be a 10-year-old boy and remembered nothing of his past, except for the recent events that brought him to Lochos. However, Perturabo calculated that he agreed to the deal with Damekos at the age of 6. Having just secured the talented child under the roof of his palace, the tyrant of Lochos immediately began inviting rulers of neighboring states to form alliances they had previously rejected. Seeing the remarkable boy who promised to become a powerful warrior while also creating incredible technological inventions, warlike neighbors hurried to agree to the agreements. Perturabo obediently participated in various trials devised by Damekos, time and again demonstrating his uniqueness. He did not revel in the victories, but harbored resentment towards the tyrant for being used as a tool to fulfill others' ambitions. The ruler of Lochos was not cruel to the young Primarch. The trials could range from creating a beautiful portrait of a visiting guest within minutes to engaging in a philosophical debate about divinity with a priest. And yet, never expressing his discontent with the proceedings, Perturabo accumulated grievances within his soul. Damekos appreciated in his protege the talents of an architect and engineer, but he said what he liked most were the boy's oratorical abilities. The young Primarch surpassed all the philosophers on the planet, correcting unashamedly the works of venerable elders with his comments and sending them back to the authors. One of these even suggested that Perturabo should study at his school, but the youth refused, boldly declaring that none of the teachers could tell him anything new or useful. The Religious Society of Olympia saw in Perturabo yet another testament to the existence of gods and their great design. However, the youth himself sternly rejected any beliefs. He was convinced that he was not the child of a mortal woman, but unlike the priests who considered him a creation of gods, he assumed he was crafted by someone's design for some important purpose. In a dispute with a representative of the local cult, the Primarch said that one day he would definitely find out who his creator was and would prove that he was no god. An infuriated priest, unable to counter Perturabo's rational arguments with his own, desperately yelled about imminent retribution. Ironically, no one took the priest's words seriously, for he spoke nonsense about foreseeing that Perturabo might become the one to destroy Olympia. 10 years after his first encounter with the tyrant, the remarkable child had transformed into an adult man. He himself presumed he was no older than 16, though he looked like a 30-year-old commander, with a black beard and icy eyes. Almost all his free time, Perturabo spent in his workshop in the attic, where his only neighbors were a few songbirds. The quarters were engulfed in disorder, where scattered on the floor lay blueprints of fantastic mechanisms next to dirty goblets and forgotten food. Although it was no difficulty for the Primarch to figure out where everything was in his room. For the attending slaves, the workshop was an inaccessible part of the palace. The youth did not trust the servants and not only refused their help, but demanded their complete absence among other family members of the tyrant during his guest visits. Damekos tried many times to find common ground with his protege, but all his attempts were doomed to failure. Perturabo easily flared up and stubbornly refused to notice warmth from those around him. The ruler of Lokos tried to think that such behavior was typical for teenagers who despised elders and denied any authorities. Yet still, he was sincerely distressed by the sudden offenses that so often enveloped Perturabo for reasons completely inexplicable to those close to him, followed by a coldness that could last for months. Wishing to demonstrate to his protege his love, which the latter stubbornly called a lie, Damekos, on Perturabo's 16th birthday, declared him his legitimate adopted son. The ruler Lokos considered his native sons incapable of wise governance, and his only daughter, Kalifone, would have become the first woman tyrant in their state, which could also have led to unfortunate consequences. However, adopting a fosterling with calculation did not at all imply a lack of paternal love. But Perturabo noticed only the calculation. According to the traditions of Olympia, on the 16th birthday, the young man was supposed to undergo a religious naming ritual. It was assumed that Perturabo, in place of his strange, self-invented name, would choose the name of one of the heroes of antiquity, which he naturally did not do, once again showing his disregard for the religion and traditions of Olympia, and most importantly, for the values honored by his adoptive father. Despite the fact that the young man refused to even explain the meaning of his name, claiming that the tyrant would not understand it, Damekos wisely did not argue and forced the priestesses conducting the naming ritual to use the non-Olympian name Perturabo. Afterwards, he noticed a fleeting smile, almost for the first time, gracing his son's face in his presence. The young Primarch rejoiced in his moral victory over his adoptive father. In addition, the young Primarch continued to address the tyrant Lokos exclusively as ruler or master, not to show his submission or loyalty, but merely to emphasize that he did not recognize his adoptive father. However, with this behavior, besides Damekos, Perturabo also saddened his half-sister Kalifone, the only living soul on Olympia whom the Primarch cared for. For 10 years, the family of ruler Lokos reached out to the young man, wishing to fill his life with warmth. But Perturabo rejected the embraces and caresses of his adopted relatives and despised what they called love. The Primarch was convinced that Damekos valued him only as an unusual weapon. The young man's talents with languages helped crack enemy codes, architectural explorations erected indestructible walls, and engineering refined the tools of death. Perturabo reproached his adoptive father for all this, twisting the events in such a way as to imply that war did not bring him pleasure, while at the same time asserting that no one could force him to engage in what he did not like. Damekos endured all the bad antics, although sometimes the son yelling in anger forced him to retreat to the opposite end of the room. Such a prudent measure also seemed insulting to Perturabo. In his opinion, if his adoptive father loved him as a real son, he would trust him and not fear being struck. And yet, even in those years, it was clear to those around him that when fury clouded Perturabo's eyes, it was best to stay away from him. Once, he nearly harmed his sister, who was his only friend on Olympia. Despite the harsh words spoken to his adoptive father, the young Primarch still cared for those around him and the family that had accepted him. He even invented a special device for testing drinks and food for the presence of poisons, which often found their way to the ruler's table. Life at the court of a tyrant greatly amplified Perturabo's natural suspicion, transforming it nearly into paranoia. Therefore, even with his sister Caliphone, he did not develop truly trusting relationships. In their hearts, they both regretted this and secretly longed for genuine warmth. Yet the Primarch's distrust knew no exceptions. The destructive consequence of such behavior would only become evident to him many years after leaving Olympia, during his last conversation with his sister. Nevertheless, in his youth, Perturabo, who was so meticulously attached to his unique name, allowed Caliphone to shorten it to the simple Beau. After one of his half-brother's visits to her chambers, Caliphone was taken hostage by hired assassins. It was evident that the main target of the attackers was the powerful adopted son of the tyrant, and the girl was used merely as a vulnerability through which to reach him. The Primarch made short work of the five mortals, despite being wounded by a dagger coated with a potent poison. The one holding the knife to Caliphone's neck was confident Perturabo wouldn't attack, believing the situation too risky. But with incredible speed, the giant pulled the poisoned dagger from his shoulder and hurled it at the assassin's head. The girl was saved. However, Perturabo's ferocious nature triumphed once again, and even the last attacker, who might have revealed the identity of the instigator, was destroyed by the enraged Primarch. His sister's attempts to halt his punitive hand were futile. She might as well have tried to move a mountain and nearly became the next victim of his blind rage. Coming to his senses, Perturabo realized his mistake and apologized, excusing his anger by saying he lost control due to his concern for Caliphone's life. Yet, he still concluded that the assassination attempt might have been orchestrated not by enemies, but by family members, half-brothers or Damecos. Courtly intrigues made Perturabo see adversaries everywhere. The fact that his loved ones cared for him, he would understand too late. As the chief warlord of Damecos, Primarch united the planet under the banners of Lokos. Being the most powerful person on Olympia, he never attempted to overthrow his adoptive father or harm the nobles of his native city-state. This could not be said about the conquered territories. There, Perturabo unleashed his cruelty, ceasing to hide his desperate fondness for war and bloodshed. The stern and fearless commander feared nothing, achieving one martial feat after another. The only thing that instilled anxiety in his rational heart was the terrifying stellar vortex, invisible to anyone but Perturabo. Years later, he shared his vision with Ferus Manus, who did not understand what his newfound brother was speaking about. At that time, almost no one guessed about the nameless abyss in the warp, which Perturabo himself would later name the Eye of Terror. Besides this, the psychic abilities of the future Primarch of the Fourth Legion manifested in prophetic dreams where he saw his true father. Guided by logic rather than faith, Perturabo had long speculated that the creator of such an extraordinary being as himself would eventually come for his creation, and dreams of the Emperor only confirmed his suspicions. As a child, Perturabo climbed a high cliff where Lokos was located, coming on his own to the guards searching for him. To meet the Emperor, the Primarch ascended a mountain 9 kilometers high, where the father who appeared eclipsed the frightening light of the stellar whirlwind with his radiance. The master of mankind came to Perturabo in the form of a mortal, whom even the kneeling Primarch surpassed in height. The Emperor listed all the achievements of his son that he had observed on Olympia, praised him for his thirst for knowledge, and promised to teach him much. Warmth and joy emanated from him, and in his wise eyes lay a sadness that the Primarch wished to dispel with his deeds. With reverent tears, The found son swore allegiance to the Emperor, for he offered to direct his outstanding talents to serve the human race. Perturabo was happy. At last, a true loving father had come for him, and he would never again be used as a living weapon or a brilliant tool of war. Upon arriving on Terra, the found Primarch met several of his brothers. However, even among his peers, he could not communicate with others with natural ease. Perturabo considered his inability to form friendships a virtue. He believed that whoever earned his trust would receive eternal iron loyalty in return. Yet, as the years would show, even iron loyalty can be broken. Nevertheless, the suspicious Primarch of the Fourth Legion formed something akin to almost friendly relations with Magnus the Red during the early years following his return to the Emperor's fold. Their shared love for study and thirst for new knowledge united them. Together, the Primarchs worked for several months on the excavation of one of the human worlds destroyed in the Age of Strife. Magnus was more interested in the esoteric and philosophical works of the sages of the vanished world, whereas Perturabo was occupied with studying the lost mechanical marvels of antiquity. All the Emperor's sons displayed a remarkable capacity to learn compared to mortals and demonstrated high intelligence. However, in the early days of Perturabo's appearance on Terra, it became clear that he was the most gifted Primarch in terms of absolute scientific knowledge and technical inventions. Yet, much of his work remained comprehensible only to Perturabo himself. Creating something beautiful and useful, just as on Olympia, he refused to explain the details, considering the interested parties incapable of understanding, even if another Primarch inquired about the future invention. The Emperor did not perceive a problem in his son's detachment and coldness towards others. He was pleased to have obtained new death-bringing weaponry for his great crusade, and saw in Perturabo a mighty warlord whose ferocious power was eclipsed only by his sharp intellect. Each battle appeared to the young Primarch merely as a problem to be identified and overcome. Very soon after his first meeting with his father, he would demonstrate to the enemies of the Imperium the dreadful power of his lethal mind. Before embarking on his first campaign under the banners of the Imperium, Perturabo ascended the summit of the Tower of Astartes to swear an oath of loyalty to the Master of Mankind, just as the previously found Primarchs had done. Each step required superhuman will and courage. This was not merely a physical ascent, but a challenge to intellect and heart, a psychic interaction with the Emperor himself, testing the furthest limits of the sun's endurance. Perturabo assumed command of the 4th Space Marine Legion, which he named the Iron Warriors, and ordered new recruits to be drawn from his home planet, Olympia. Notably, this world entered the Imperium's fold more swiftly and orderly than many others, hoping that life under the Emperor's rule would elevate their existence even higher than Perturabo had with his technologies. At the time the Iron Warriors were handed over to their Primarch, the Legion numbered about 35,000 Space Marines. However, upon studying the history of their military operations, Perturabo was disappointed. In his view, the legions of his brothers had performed an incomparably greater number of feats, and thus the disgraced sons needed to be punished. The method of punishment came to him from the harsh traditions of Olympia, previously so fervently rejected by the Primarchs. Decimation, a procedure well known to the 12th Legion of Angron, representing a voluntary shameful death for every 10th Space Marine. However, while the brutal Primarch of the 12th used it as punishment for failure, Perturabo resorted to decimation simply because his sons were not as impeccable as he wished to see them. The Iron Lord believed that war is indifferent, relentless and blind, and therefore the price for weakness must be the same, blind, random and ruthless. Those who were destined to pay the bloody tribute by their father's order were forced by their legion brothers to be killed with bare hands, so that the shameful and bitter death would forever imprint on the hearts of the survivors. Upon learning of the events, many members of the Emperor's court expressed their protest, believing that the 4th Legion was mistakenly placed under a bloodthirsty madman, while others justified the Primarch's brutal act by his loyalty to the traditions of Olympia and proposed to give him time to understand the cultural values of the Imperium, only then allowing him to lead the Iron Warriors. Louder than all, Gilliman voiced his indignation over the shameful and unjust deaths of the valiant warriors with whom his ultramarines had to fight shoulder to shoulder. This sowed the first seeds of enmity between the two primarchs, fertilized by the Emperor's complete disregard for the decimation of the Fourth Legion. However, the Iron Warriors themselves thoroughly learned the lesson and understood that Perturabo's rule would be ruthless, merciless, without favor or favoritism, and that death would be the price of any blunder, for war to their father was merely a curious equation. They were punished not due to a mistake or failure in the Great Crusade before the Primarch's arrival. No, their guilt lay in Perturabo's belief that his sons had not realized their full potential. Merely good warriors of the Adeptus Astartes were insufficient for him. The Iron Lord wanted his legion to be recognized as the best among all others. Relationships with his subordinates, including the senior captains within his trident, vividly demonstrate the Primarch's arrogant and cruel nature. For some reason, Perturabo deemed it necessary time and again to humiliate those around him. Speaking of the inaccessibility of his greatest intellect to the primitive space marines, despite the fact that everyone knew this already. Due to the Iron Lord's harsh methods and dark example, suspicions, malicious distrust, and callous indifference towards the lives of others awakened in the souls of the Astartes of the Fourth Legion. This created a rift between the Iron Warriors and the other legions, which only pleased Perturabo, highlighting the uniqueness of his resolute and ruthless sons. The Fourth Legion was most often deployed for siege attacks, relying on the effective interplay of the Primarch's genius with the strength and dedication of the Space Marines. The Iron Lord's readiness to sacrifice everything for victory led to his legion suffering the highest number of losses among the forces participating in the Great Crusade. The contempt and disdain from their father, along with constant senseless deaths, led even the enhanced warriors resistant to psychological trauma along a path that slowly and painfully brought them toward disaster. The soldiers of the Imperial Army, unfortunate enough to fight under Perturabo's command, were doomed. The Primarch used human resources not as auxiliary forces but as deliberate expenditures, cannon fodder for the attrition of enemy firepower, thousands of sacrificial waves merely to assess the time it would take for the opponent to destroy a certain number of mortal fighters. Such recurring incidents created a negative reputation for the Fourth Legion. Soldiers even staged mutinies before battles, unwilling to become expendable. Their rebellions were swiftly suppressed time and again by the Space Marines. However, when rumors reached the War Master, he ordered Perturabo to relinquish all human divisions and henceforth use convicted criminals for such tactics so as not to undermine the warriors' morale. Over the decades of the Great Crusade, the Iron Warriors managed to foster negative relations with almost every other Space Marine Legion. The Raven Guard despised them after a cycle of joint battles in the Relentless War. The Imperial Fists maintained constant fierce rivalry with them, and the White Scars and Space Wolves referred to the Fourth Legion in their chronicles as an unnamed ally, even though in their joint war against the Orcs, victory was achieved solely thanks to Perturabo. In retrospect, this ever-widening rift between brothers appears more evident than it seemed to contemporaries. But after Horus was appointed War Master, the condition of the Iron Warriors began to deteriorate even faster. There is an opinion that the Emperor assigned Perturabo the most complex missions, knowing that no one else could handle such tasks. At the same time, the Archtraitor continued to assign the Fourth Legion to the most challenging battles, but with the goal of undermining his brother's mental state, hastening his downfall. Moreover, Horus ordered the Iron Warriors to be divided, sending them to different ends of the galaxy as part of numerous expeditions. For instance, a mere 10 Space Marines were sent to one world for compliance, while the planet's population numbered 130 million people. Other Primarchs, such as Leman Russ, Vulcan, and Magnus the Red, refused the order to divide their warriors, but Perturabo silently complied. As in the past, he quietly carried out tasks he disliked, but only to harbor grievances. The Iron Warriors transformed into garrison forces with numerous stations across the Imperium. and their undeniable success in sieges led the 4th Legion to be automatically assigned to all siege missions, ignoring the Astartes' needs for rest or reorganization. Viewing his brother as an unrivaled destroyer of fortifications, other Primarchs forgot that he, above all, possessed a unique mind and sense of beauty. The Iron Lord was not the greatest psyker, understanding the flow of the warp like Magnus, nor a gifted swordsman like Fulgrim. The main strength and simultaneous curse of Perturabo was that his boundless genius went underestimated. The Primarch could discuss the intricacies of the most advanced technologies with the highest adepts of the Mechanicum, being not just a skilled master, but a creator. Furthermore, over the years of serving the Emperor, Perturabo amassed a grand collection of masterpieces, surpassing the libraries of Guilliman and Magnus. It contained countless works of art, scrolls with images of astonishing inventions, and blueprints of architectural marvels crafted by the Primarch. There were plans for luxurious amphitheatres, the industrial infrastructure of sprawling hive cities, impregnable citadels, and richly decorated palaces to rival the mountain stronghold of the Emperor himself. No architect in the galaxy could have ever imagined the structure that Perturabo conceived and designed. To any other creator, such constructions would seem miraculous, yet not the fruits of a genius mind. However, the Iron Lord was associated with destruction and death, not with the creation of new wonders. So should an outsider happen upon his treasury, they would never suspect that all the astounding projects on the drafting tables were the work of the 4th Legion's father. Though there was indeed one grand project of Perturabo that was realized, his exquisite amphitheatre was used for the Council of Nicaea. The Primarch had intended it as a stage for contests of athletic prowess, but the arena became a place of condemnation. Despite the fact that soon after the edict's issuance, the amphitheatre was dismantled, Perturabo forever remembered Nicaea as his own shameful defeat and humiliation at the hands of the Emperor. The Primarch's genius was not limited to the drafting board. He also created hundreds of unusual machines, various ornaments and wondrous constructions that seemed impossible to model. There were musical instruments made of precious metals, adorned with shining gems, items reminiscent of what in ancient times would have been called Fabergé eggs, miniature war machines, moving models of animals, humans and xenos, as well as almost fairy tale bird cages, in which Perturabo's loyal feathered companions would never feel confined in freedom. Only members of his trident were allowed into this Primarch's treasury, and no one else knew of the existence of this wondrous place. Perturabo appreciated this secret, keeping the presence of beauty in his soul hidden. Although in the early years after his discovery, the Primarch behaved differently. During that period, he created the Golden Lion, which was never to be sent to the Father of the Dark Angels, Lion L. Johnson, and the Celestial Clock, which Guilliman installed on the highest tower of his Temple of Correction on Macrag. But afterward, natural reticence and suspicion prevailed over the initial joy of meeting his true family. And Perturabo once again distanced himself from everyone, much as he did in his workshop on Olympia. The Iron Lord mastered many languages of the Xenos, including several Eldar dialects and the guttural language through which the Orcs communicated. Attention to detail accompanied Perturabo throughout his life. He reveled in counting minutiae in any endeavor, whether it was the destruction of an enemy fortress or establishing the golden ratio in his new creation. Angron considered it a pointless waste of time, while Guilliman, to the contrary, praised such meticulousness. Two Primarchs, so unlike each other in their opposing assessments of Perturabo's activities, were both right in their own ways. Yet neither suspected how bitter and uncompromising the Iron Overlord's demands were upon himself. The Primarch was cruel to his sons, but he demanded 100 times more from himself. All his works had to be perfected as long as they existed. And each task was executed with such meticulousness by the master as if it might be his last in life. Notably, brutal customs inherited from Olympia thrived in the 4th Legion, and the Primarch himself resorted to traditions and words brought from his native world, even though, under the rule of his adoptive father in Locos, he rejected the local culture. A fitting example of this is the Logos, the Terminator armor of Perturabo, which he personally constructed and named in resonance with the city-state where the Iron Overlord grew up. Besides providing an extraordinary level of protection, the armor supported complex control systems linking the Primarch to all the divisions under his command. It included various types of weaponry, also created by Perturabo, a controller for managing automata, and a teleportation device. Given how much a warrior's armor means to him, one can assume that by bestowing it with the name of his homeland, the Primarch wanted to emphasize not only his origin, but also his warm feelings toward his past on Olympia. Subsequent events only confirmed this. Over a century and a half of service to the Emperor, Perturabo conducted numerous highly complex operations, the last of which was the cleansing of several planets in the Sactrada Deeps from the Hruds. These Xenos, sometimes called Tempora Ferox, are a loathsome and dangerous species, parasitic on other races. They are rarely recognizable by appearance, as Hruds prefer to wrap themselves in long robes that entirely conceal their outlines. The bodies of these Xenos secrete a poison adapted to the native species of the planet they inhabit. However, they do not engage in open wars and more frequently just establish settlements in dark caves, where they sift through their precious junk, which they constantly carry, guarding against thieves. For the inhabitants of such a world, the Xenos do not pose an acute threat. Nonetheless, once they occupy certain territories, the aliens begin to consider all nearby humans their property. Moreover, the habitats of the Hruds gradually become polluted and toxic from the substances they spread. Historical records even mention cases where humans lived alongside these Xenos for such prolonged periods that they died after separation due to a lack of the toxins they had grown accustomed to. But the most dangerous ability of the Hruds is the entropic field created by their bodies. The presence of these Xenos causes objects to decay rapidly and humans to either age into the elderly or revert to infancy. Since the colonies usually become caves, slums, and other unpopular places, the human population rarely feels such a devastating effect. However, during the mass migrations of the Hrud clusters, their very presence becomes a weapon, annihilating everything in its path. For this reason, this species is classified as an extreme Xeno threat. Purging planets of Hruds, the Iron Warriors encountered a true nightmare, capable of depriving one not only of life, but of sanity as well. Solar storms, tectonic instability, ruptures in space and time, and even the planet shattered by the Xenos, on which they ultimately concealed themselves from Imperial forces, did not intimidate as much as what transpired with the warriors themselves throughout the battles. The time-manipulating enemies could halt it for a specific Astartes for a century, thus extracting their mind from the combat and returning it. Disoriented, the Space Marine would lose focus and perish. Other Hruds, in contrast, accelerated events or interchanged moments, transforming occurrences into a chaotic kaleidoscope of disjointed scenes. Swords would turn to dust upon striking the Xenos' blades, and pierced bodies of Imperial soldiers would alter their form and explode. Some Space Marines, caught in the zone of temporal distortion, would rapidly de-age in an instant, brimming with vigor and power, only to suffer a painful demise from implant rejection. Realizing how arduous the confrontation with such an enemy would be, Perturabo personally led the assault. His flawless armor tarnished but did not disintegrate under the influence of the Hruds. The body and face of the Primarch showed no signs of aging. Hruds were not invincible. They were slain by bolters, swords, and the bare hands of Astartes. Yet, the genius of the Primarch did not cease with mere brute force. In collaboration with the Mechanicum, he devised a weapon that would reverse the temporal fabric in opposition to the direction intended by the Xenos. This invention not only shielded the Space Marines from the destructive influence, but also massacred the Hruds in large numbers. Nevertheless, the complete eradication of the Tempora Ferox was not achieved. They tore apart the planet, transforming the capital into a floating island and vanished, slicing a rift in space. The backlash from their jump scattered the Iron Warriors' expedition fleet within a radius of one astronomical unit, with all ships rendered immobile and some even exploding. Silently observing his sons perish, the Primarch thought of only one thing. This senseless and bloody war served solely to gratify the Emperor's vanity. Despite these thoughts, Perturabo was furious with the battle's outcome and vented his displeasure by humiliating the commanders he deemed responsible for the defeat. Subordinates knew that during such moments, the wisest course was to remain out of the Primarch's sight to avoid becoming another victim of his hasty wrath. Yet, some were still assigned the suicidal role of messengers bearing bad news. The Imperial officer tasked with bringing Perturabo news of the betrayal of his native Olympia knew he would not return alive, and so it was. The Primarch tore him apart with his bare hands, even as the unfortunate soul barely finished his sentence. The arrogance of the Iron Warlord stemmed from his pride in his harsh homeworld, which Perturabo regarded as exemplary. With immense effort, the Primarch restrained his desire to slaughter everyone aboard the ship. The disobedience of Olympia was seen by him as a personal disgrace. Sacrificing forces necessary for pursuing Xenos, Perturabo directed his fleet to his birthplace. There exists a notion that the fallen Horus intentionally orchestrated the misfortunes accompanying the Fourth Legion's expedition, including igniting the fires of rebellion on Olympia so that a disillusioned brother might more readily side with him. However, the inhabitants of the world explained their defiance with objective reasons. According to them, the better life promised by the Imperium had never arrived. Instead, it had only worsened. The minor internal conflicts that had previously prevailed on the planet occasionally claimed the lives of dozens of warriors, but with the Emperor's arrival, Olympia began losing thousands of young people annually. The populace disliked that their children were taken, transformed, and led to their deaths for wars on unknown worlds. In the eyes of mortals, the Astartes born from them became mere expendable material for the Imperium, not heroes as propaganda proclaimed. For 150 years, Olympia had existed submissively under the Emperor's wing, but the spark of rebellion flared as soon as the tyrant Damekos died. Upon arriving on the planet, Perturabo's first act was to meet with the protest leaders from whom he listened to all their grievances. Yet despite the fact that Olympia's populace did not desire open conflict and were ready for compromises, explaining everything that had transpired as a result of their desperate situation, the Primarch remained true to his cruelty. Perturabo was enraged upon hearing news of the uprising, but the ingratitude of his homeworld utterly blinded him. The selfish inhabitants cared for their planet as if they thought of it as their own, merely because it was where the Primarch was discovered. The Iron Warlord was infuriated at the thought that Olympia did not appreciate his greatest contribution to the protection of humanity. He fought in the darkness of space, saving the galaxy from monstrous Xenos, yet the people failed to comprehend this. If only they were capable of seeing even one of the nightmare worlds cleansed by Perturabo, they would have willingly given him their children. But such was beyond mortal understanding, and the Primarch ordered the planet to be punished. Part of the Iron Warlord's mind, which once wisely governed his actions, had by that time already lost its influence. Before the eyes of the emissaries who had come for negotiations, a city was incinerated and a familiar sentence was pronounced upon the entire planet: decimation. Perturabo decreed that the regions must voluntarily execute every 10th inhabitant. However, should the Iron Warriors not see funeral pyres upon approaching the city gates, half of the population would be exterminated by Astartes' hands and the city burned. The leaders of the rebellion had their heads severed and sent back to their comrades. Olympia was ablaze with countless fires of burning settlements. The seemingly impregnable towers and walls, once erected by Perturabo himself, were now being destroyed by his own hands. The local army had no defense against the Iron Warriors. Space Marines, driven mad by decades of inglorious battles and constant humiliation, took their Primarch's betrayal as the final straw. The legionaries slaughtered people and set homes aflame, mercilessly killing brothers who attempted to stop the insane bloodshed. Only a few had the mental strength to sabotage the monstrous orders. Some Astartes, entering the homes of mortals, noted the pervasive poverty in the dwellings of common folk. Dinners interrupted by the warriors might consist only of a few crusts of bread. The Space Marines involuntarily remembered their own childhood on Olympia and the promises of a better life for their homeland that recruiters had used to motivate them. As the rebels claimed, The Imperium brought common people nothing but new losses. Those Astartes who tried to share these thoughts with their legion brethren invariably died as traitors. The last bastion on Perturabo's path was his native Locos. The city was fortified better than any other on the planet and was considered nearly indestructible. It was surrounded on three sides by high walls designed by the Primarch, with a sheer cliff on the fourth side and a single road, which the residents had destroyed. The Iron Lord captured the city with grim satisfaction. It was as if he was confronting himself, once again demonstrating his unmatched genius and yet again destroying the wonders created by his own hands. Once in the tyrant's castle, Perturabo headed towards the hall where his foster father, Domekos, lay in final repose. The dead tyrant, encased in a transparent coffin, appeared majestic and proud, not cunning and calculating as the young Primarch had seen him. In that moment, the Iron Lord addressed Domekos for the first time, calling him father, with a bitter realization that his belated feelings were of no use to the dead man. However, Perturabo was heard. In the darkness of the room was his sister, by adoption, Caliphone. The Primarch recognized her immediately, though he saw an old woman instead of the beautiful girl he had almost loved. Such warm feelings he had only ever felt towards the Emperor. But his sister had changed not only in appearance. Once cheerful and mischievous, she was now caustic and cold, as if she had not forgiven Perturabo for something. Caliphone mockingly noted that after over 150 years, her half-brother finally acknowledged her and Domekos as his kin. She told the Primarch that she had been mistaken in considering him a gift from the gods, because in reality her half-brother was their punishment. The Iron Lord was unfazed by such words, since he had never listened to religious rhetoric. However, there exists an opinion that the calamities which befell Perturabo and his sons arose partly from his militant denial. Throughout his life, the Primarch rejected any beliefs guided solely by logic. Nevertheless, the imperial truth never became close to him. The Iron Lord and his warriors found themselves battle-hardened for decades without truly knowing the cause they served. In that conversation, the Primarch inquired of his sister about the involvement of another brother, Andos, whom he secretly considered superior to himself. The mortal son of a tyrant might have been deemed the most gifted creator of Olympia had Perturabo not been present there. Yet Andos, possessing harmony and tranquility within his soul, never envied him. Caliphone informed him that her brother had renounced any claim to the throne and lived his life working in his workshop, peacefully passing away many years ago. Such a blissful fate of a simple mortal was beyond the Primarch's reach. While discussing his disillusionment with the ideals of the Master of Mankind with his sister, Perturabo compared the Imperium to his dreams of the greatest edifices for a perfect society. Realizing the futility of all he had done throughout his life, the Iron Lord did not notice when a tear slipped from his eye. Everything that had ever tormented him came crashing down at once. The disdain of his brothers and the cold calculativeness of his father's, the eternal limitation of his own potential, and the feeling of being abandoned by all. Perturabo resented this momentary weakness for lamenting not his shattered dreams but himself. Yet Caliphone did not pity him, instead calling him weak. For decades, the woman observed her brother's campaigns, witnessing how the Emperor's service allowed Perturabo's most troubling traits to grow and overshadow his virtues. The Primarch believed that the Master of Mankind undervalued him, and thus sent him to the most difficult places. Caliphone, on the other hand, thought the Emperor held her brother in higher regard than others and entrusted him with complex tasks, understanding that no one else would handle them better. The Iron Lord justified his uncompromising nature and brutality with efficiency, contrasting it with the perceived weakness of others. Caliphone saw it instead as his desire to present himself to others as a sufferer. Perturabo allowed the division of his legion, silently accepted any order, and executed each task in the most excruciating manner, hoping others would recognize how much he sacrificed himself and his sons. From his adolescent years, the Primarch distanced himself from others, hiding from his first family in the attic, and later from his second deep within his workshop on his flagship. However, he did this not because he did not need company, but so that someone might glimpse the diamond of his genius in the darkness and admire how hard Perturabo worked without a single complaint. Caliphone blamed her half-brother for never growing into a man, remaining forever an aggrieved adolescent. In the tyrant's daughter's view, this, rather than the emperor and human uprisings, led to Olympia's destruction. In her final remark, Caliphone managed to say that while vividly feigning disdain for love, Perturabo, in truth, craved it above all else, but was denied it due to his own wretched egotism. Therefore, in Caliphone's eyes, the wisest Primarch turned out to be the biggest fool she had ever met. Enraged, Perturabo strangled his sister with his own hands, yet in those moments when life was leaving her body, the Primarch saw neither fear nor contempt in the woman's eyes, only pity. At first he wanted to tear the dead old woman into many pieces, but when the wave of anger subsided, the Primarch shuddered with disgust at his own act. He had killed the only person who cared for him and destroyed his native Olympia. At the moment of realizing this, Perturabo felt his soul break under the weight of all-encompassing shame. The Primarch imagined what his brothers would say upon learning what had happened and realized that Caliphone was right. He so wanted to hear praise that, repeatedly encountering indifference, he inadvertently set himself the goal of earning at least condemnation. "The Emperor will never forgive me," the Iron Lord repeated the phrase endlessly. He was certain that now there was no way back. Shortly, devastated Olympia received news of the burning of Prospero by Leman Russ's sons and of the actions of the traitor Horus on Istvan III. A civil war was igniting in the galaxy. By the Emperor's order, the Iron Warriors were dispatched to Istvan V to support the Loyalist forces. But by that day, Perturabo had already sided with the arch-traitor, who promised never to reproach his brother for destroying Olympia. After the victory in the Landing Zone massacre, Horus decided to reward the Iron Lord for his support. Thus, Perturabo obtained a warhammer, the Forgebreaker, once forged by Fulgrim for Ferus Manus. This gift, according to the design of the fallen warlord, was meant to become a symbol of the Iron Warriors and their father's loyalty to Horus, and many considered the hammer to be the binding piece of the Primarch's pact. Only Perturabo knew that in reality they were bound by the promised forgiveness of Olympia. Among the Primarchs, no one resembled the father of the Fourth Legion as much as Rogel Dorn. Both were characterized by silence and steadfastness, similar methods of war, and aspirations for creation. But despite what might seem like a shared worldview, Perturabo and Rogel hated each other almost from their first meeting. The Iron Lord likely considered himself more deserving of the role the Emperor allocated to Dorn. And shortly after the massacre on Istvan V, the Iron Warriors had an opportunity to take revenge against the Seventh Legion for the grievances inflicted. Preparing for the defense of Terra, Rogel Dorn ordered all parts of his legion to arrive on the throne world, but a contingent of Imperial Fists stationed on the planet Hydra Cordatus was unable to leave due to the sudden death of their navigator. Thus, the Iron Warriors attacked the planet with intensive bombardment and then landed on its surface along with their Primarch. The magma bombs boiled the rivers and fertile fields turned into scorched deserts, but the citadel of the Seventh Legion remained untouched. With such precision, Perturabo sought once again to demonstrate his superiority over the enemy. However, thanks to the craftsmanship of ancient builders and the bravery of the defenders, the fortress withstood nearly 3 months of siege. On the day the defense fell, the Iron Warriors destroyed 52 Space Marines of the Imperial Fists, as well as 13,000 mortal men and women sheltering in the citadel. Perturabo himself personally killed 30 Astartes. The Iron Warriors cleansed the planet, turning the few survivors into slaves. Shortly after this victory, the Emperor's children, led by their Primarch Fulgrim, arrived on Hydra Cordatus. The Iron Lord was not friendly with the Phoenician nor with his other brothers, but he respected Fulgrim for his pursuit of perfection. Throughout his life, Perturabo moved toward the same goal and therefore agreed to cooperate, considering Fulgrim to be a dependable ally. The father of the Iron Warriors assumed that his brother wanted to propose a joint effort to conquer Mars, as Horus strategically needed the Forge cities and the support of the Mechanicum. The capture plan promised to become another masterpiece of Perturabo's genius, where the Emperor's children would play the role of allies to the Iron Warriors. But Fulgrim had completely different plans. The Phoenician suggested his brother go in search of a remarkable weapon, capable of realizing all the Iron Lord's designs and ensuring they never disappoint. In addition to this, the father of the Fourth Legion was presented with a splendid cloak with a precious gemstone on the clasp. Fulgrim said that by combining forces, the two legions would find the desired weapon more quickly, thus bringing Horus's victory closer. Perturabo was skeptical of the Phoenix's words, but upon hearing that the weapon was located in a warp storm, he changed his mind. According to Fulgrim, the ancient Xenos weapon, the Angel Exterminatus, was so powerful that the stars themselves turned around it, forming a vortex that the Iron Lord named the Eye of Terror. The terrifying phenomenon had haunted Perturabo since his earliest years. He saw it in the sky over every conquered planet. And only on the day of his first meeting with the Emperor did the oppressive occurrence dissolve, giving way to a dark sky. The Primarch of the Iron Warriors recalled sharing his troubling vision with Ferus Manus, only to read disdain and accusations of weakness in his brother's gaze in response. Since then, he had spoken to no one about the stellar vortex, and now Fulgrim himself proposed an expedition to the warp storm. Perturabo felt relieved as he arrived at the border of the Eye of Terror. Others could see it too, albeit slightly differently than the Primarch. Looking at the breach, the Iron Lord sensed the cries of devoured worlds, the moments of their fall racing before his eyes as phantom images. He saw planets plunged into madness where physical laws no longer applied. It was then that the largest storm in the galaxy of those years received its name. The destination within the Eye of Terror was the planet Idris, which had anciently been one of the worlds of the Eldar. The surface had been almost untouched by the warp storm, and so the Iron Warriors annihilated everything around the citadel with pinpoint bombardment, which was to become the final destination of the expedition, where calculations suggested the tomb of the Angel Exterminatus was located. The Eldar present on the planet engaged in confrontation with the forces of the two legions, but were crushed. Perturabo and Fulgrim personally led their warriors. The Phoenix did not encroach upon his brother's leading role in this battle, but constantly urged him on. On the way to the tomb, the Iron Lord carefully studied Fulgrim's and his Astarte's appearance. Even at their encounter on Hydrocordatus, the Third Legion had struck him with its depraved vulgarity, but now a strange sickness had been added to it. Fulgrim exuded an odd, almost deadly radiance, which clearly lacked space within a living being. Perturabo absolutely did not trust his brother, considering him Horus's most unreliable ally, but still decided to bring the search to completion. The traitor forces were suddenly attacked by a multitude of Eldar automatons, but even fighting for his life, the Iron Lord managed to notice how Fulgrim slipped away in the midst of the battle. The Primarch followed his brother down an endless staircase, a glowing point of light in the distance. It turned out that Idris was a hollow planet with colossal emptiness and a bright sun instead of a core. Perturabo was infuriated upon realizing the vanity-filled Fulgrim's deceit. The Angel Exterminatus never existed. The Iron Lord attempted to strike his brother, but he was brought to his knees by the utterance of a monstrous word, tearing his mind apart. The precious stone, adorning the cloak gifted by the Phoenix to Perturabo, exhausted the iron strengths of the owner, sacrificing them on the altar of Fulgrim's ascension. The father of the Iron Warriors tried to see in his brother's eyes a hint of remorse and shame for the intention to sacrifice a close one to his ambitions, but saw there only the desire to become a god. Perturabo hurled the stone that was killing him into the abyss and attacked Fulgrim with his hammer. Ironically, the blow that shattered Fulgrim's mortal shell was struck with a hammer that he himself had forged hundreds of years ago. The Phoenix's armor evaporated and he soared upward in a stream of light, becoming for a few moments as pure and immaculate as before his fall, but only to then turn into a serpentine horned monster before Perturabo's stunned eyes. As soon as the transformation was complete, the Emperor's children, along with their Primarch, vanished in teleportation flashes, leaving the Iron Warriors on a disintegrating planet. The 4th Legion played a significant role in the Siege of Terror, where Perturabo had the opportunity to demonstrate his genius in destroying the fortifications built by Rogel Dorn. Despite the arrogance and obsession that consumed the Primarch of the 4th Legion, he remained the most rational ally of the Archtraitor. Angron and Fulgrim were engrossed in their passions. Magnus was absent. Conrad Kurz remained an unreliable madman. And only Perturabo was engaged in organizing the attack on the Imperial Palace. The Iron Lord never got the chance to determine whose talents, his or Rogel Dorn's, were more skillful, as Horus fell before the Defense of Terror. Thus, the rivalry between the Primarch of the 4th and the 7th Legions persisted. On the planet Sebastus IV, Perturabo erected a citadel trap for the father of the Imperial Fists, which he named the Eternal Fortress. However, the traitor's triumph entered history as the Battle of the Iron Cage. Upon learning of his brother's fortifications, Dorn proclaimed that he would crush the defenses and bring Perturabo back to Terra in the Iron Cage. Gilliman offered his assistance in the siege, but the Praetorian was too proud to accept it. This rash decision cost Rogel Dorn dearly. The Iron Lord not only surpassed him, but did so in a manner that ensured both his brother and his legion felt the utmost humiliation. For 3 weeks, the bloodied Imperial Fists fought due to the stubbornness of their own father, who decided not to retreat until death. They were saved from complete annihilation by the arrival of Gilliman and Perturabo's delay of the final blow, wishing to torment his hated brother for as long as possible. The Iron Lord did not wish to fight two legions simultaneously and focused all efforts on preventing Dorn from evacuating the wounded and retrieving the gene seed of the slain from the battlefield. This crippled the Imperial Fists Legion, depriving them of the capability to fight for the next 19 years. The traitors sacrificed the stolen gene seed to the Dark Gods, elevating the father of the Iron Warriors to the rank of a demon prince of the undivided chaos. There is a theory stating that Perturabo, always thinking and acting contrary, lacked a solid foundation to create his own beliefs, merely rejecting existing ones, but never offering an alternative. Such reasoning leads to the conclusion that the mantle of the Primarch became for him merely a license for mass killings, a craving for which manifested even in his early years. One can long speculate how a talented young man, over the course of 200 years, arrived at such an ignominious end. But the truth is that sometimes no fatal event is required for someone to silently turn into a monster.